As the impeachment trial resumes, how closely are Texas women listening? A closer exploration of an important demographic in this election year today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. Other stories we're tracking: scores of Houston families on the long road to rebuilding after a massive explosion late last week. We'll hear the latest. The Trump administration issues new orders to deal with so-called birth tourism. We'll have the what and the why. Plus, after a 7-year studio silence, a groundbreaking singer-songwriter reemerges, our conversation with Terry Allen, and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 27th day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Monday. With the impeachment drama unfolding in Washington, more on that a little later in the broadcast, by the way. It's difficult to imagine any story capturing more attention at the moment, but then an unthinkable headline on Sunday, the entire world in shock over the loss of one of the greatest players in professional basketball history, Kobe Bryant, dead at the age of 41, along with his daughter and 7 others, all traveling to his daughter's basketball game when that helicopter went down north of Los Angeles. The news broke barely 90 minutes before a whole slate of NBA games on Sunday afternoon, and among the first teams to tip off as word spread, the Houston Rockets and Denver Nuggets playing at the Pepsi Center in Denver. They held a moment of silence before the game began. On Friday, Northwest Houston was rocked by a tragedy much closer to home, an explosion at the Watson Grinding Manufacturing Plant. This was a blast that killed at least 2 workers, sent nearly 20 others to the hospital, and according to the Houston Chronicle, damaged more than 200 homes nearby, leaving a few dozen of them uninhabitable. So reports Perla Treviso for the Houston Chronicle. She's been talking with residents, visiting with them, those affected by the explosion. Perla, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this neighborhood in Northwest Houston. This is a mixture of some petrochemical plants and residential neighborhoods, as I understand.
Not necessarily petrochemical plants. There's some businesses, some industry, and a lot of houses, churches. So there's about 2 neighborhoods that were greatly impacted on both sides of this plant. And then there's a lot of houses, 1- and 2-story houses, manicured lawns. It's a very diverse community. I met residents who were originally from Mexico, from Vietnam, from Korea, from Houston all their life. A lot of them had been in those houses for 15, 20 years.
Some people had actually survived Hurricane Harvey and moved to this area because they thought it would be safer. Is that right?
Yes, I talked to a woman who actually had been, not necessarily Harvey, was even before, I think she mentioned Allison, and she had been flooded 3 times before the government bought her house and asked her to relocate on a non-flood zone area. And mm-hmm. So she found this house, fell in love with the neighborhood, with the house, and here she was again having to probably relocate. Her house was one of the most damaged homes that I saw over the weekend, and it's likely uninhabitable.
You described something that's pretty eerie there, that you had the chaos and confusion of Friday. And then on Saturday morning, as people were trying to figure out just what was left, there was this sort of stillness.
Yeah, so I arrived probably 8:30 or before 9, and I had left the evening prior, and you know you have all the police cars and ambulances and firefighting trucks, and then I return and there's this quiet in the neighborhood and emptiness, and you just see the rubble, the trash cans full of glass and broken mirrors. And then as the morning starts progressing, then you start seeing the people come back, those who had left their houses coming back and starting to cover, board up the windows and try to put tarp on the roofs because we were expecting pretty heavy rainfall on Saturday night.
What sort of reaction were you getting from some of those residents? Did they seem optimistic? Did they think that, I don't want to characterize it. What did you see?
Yeah, a lot of them were still in shock, I think. They had seen the mess that this blast had left the night before, and then coming back and seeing that again and broad daylight once more, and just kind of unsure of what was going to happen next. Some people did have insurance. Other people did not have insurance. Some people were renting their homes. Some people had paid it off, and you know, that had been their dream home. And they wonder, am I going to be able to own a house again in my lifetime? And it was more than the house. It was all the mementos that you build in a home, how you make it a home. And all of that was gone in a few seconds.
You report that more than 100 volunteers showed up to help cut plywood to cover up windows and repair damaged roofs. Some of these folks were from church groups. They had been part of Hurricane Harvey?
Correct. So Restoration Team is a network of more than a dozen churches, and they form after Harvey. Since then, they've kind of been helping out after disasters or after incidents like this to make sure that residents have the physical and spiritual help that they need. And so they were helping residents board their windows, but also if they needed counseling or just someone to hold their hand, they were also there to do that. And then there were also, beyond the restoration team, there were other groups of volunteers walking around and trying to make sure that everyone had the help they need. There was also the Red Cross, as well as city officials.
A long road ahead for these homeowners, and of course the investigation continues into what actually caused this plant explosion. Houston Chronicle environmental reporter Perla Treviso and the team at the Chronicle continue to cover this story. We'll link to Perla's latest at texasstandard.org. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to speak with us on The Standard.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Until recently, it was illegal to open a gun store close to a school, public park, or place of worship in Galveston. The regulation had been in place for several years up until last Thursday, when the Galveston City Council unanimously voted to repeal the measure, that after a letter from Attorney General Ken Paxton's office saying that the reg ran afoul of state law and could lead to a lawsuit. In some ways, this affair speaks to our perceptions. For the Guns and America Project, reporter Heath Drusen has been asking, when you look at a gun, what do you see?
You guys, your aches are ready. Did you want Russell for your game? Is that what you were calling?
Yeah.
So my name's Jenny Lingle, and I live in Boise, Idaho.
It's Friday morning, and Jenny's house is buzzing with the sounds of young children. Her daughters and a friend sit at the kitchen table, chatting between bites of breakfast.
They're tinier than him.
Her kids are what got Jenny into activism.
I started volunteering with Mom's Band Action about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago.
As we talk, Jenny's daughters, Ruby and Lucy, and their friend Hannah run underfoot while Jenny butters toast and serves eggs. Jenny says when she first started to volunteer, she was
just feeling pretty helpless and overwhelmed by the amount of gun violence that was going on. And I just don't think it has to be this way. I don't think we have to live in a country where people shoot each other all the time.
Most days, Jenny works as a nurse at a local hospital. But on days like today, she's half of an elementary school carpool, getting her two daughters and their friend ready for school.
Anna, you are hungry, girlfriend.
I think that experience of having a child changes you in every possible way. I'm a fourth-generation Idahoan. I've grown up in Idaho for most of my life. I've lived in lots of rural parts of the state. So I was born in Haley, Idaho, lived in Dietrich, Idaho.
Holiday season, loop dee-doo.
Haley and Dietrich are small towns on the doorstep of Idaho's backcountry.
I grew up around guns. I come from a huge hunting and sport shooting family. Dad, stepdad, brothers, much of their free time revolves around it. They own a lot of guns. So growing up, we had a lot of guns in our house, but they were always locked in a big gun safe in my parents' closet. So I never saw them unless they were being brought out for hunting or sports shooting. I never saw a gun just laying around.
Can I have another piece of toast?
No.
Please, you're good.
I remember after my first daughter was born in 2012, I was on maternity leave still. I got in the car to drive to get groceries with her one day and turned on the radio, and Sandy Hook had just happened. And I just remember this, like, deep, deep sorrow and just this pit of fear that I just could not imagine losing my child, especially to gun violence.
We pretend we don't have a mom.
When you do look at a gun, what do you see now?
I do not buy into the fact that all guns are dangerous or that all people with guns are dangerous. I think when I see a gun in a public place, I experience fear. I have that response of why is that person carrying a gun in public? When I see someone out in the woods hunting with a gun, or I see a hunting rifle being loaded up into a truck for hunting, I think, oh, fun. Contextually, it matters to me where that gun is and what, where it's being carried and what it's being used for.
Love you so much. Have a great day, Hannah. Have a good pajama.
In Idaho, we have a problem with suicide, and that problem revolves around suicide with firearms.
Idaho has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, and firearm is by far the most common method.
And so I do think there is an undercurrent to even Idaho gun culture that isn't being talked about fairly, and that's that piece, that suicide by firearm, and what do we need to be doing differently.
And it's not a problem unique to Idaho. Less than a quarter of Americans can correctly identify suicide as being responsible for the most gun deaths.
We are losing a lot of our people to suicide by firearm, particularly our men in rural Idaho.
For Guns and America, I'm Heath Drusen.
Guns in America and our partner station KERA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org. Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, on this Monday. Find out what Texans are talking about. What are you seeing out there?
Hi, David. Well, President Trump allegedly told former National Security Advisor John Bolton he was withholding Ukraine aid until officials helped with investigations into the Democrats, including the Bidens. This report, published in the New York Times, seemingly confirming a quid pro quo between Ukraine and the White House. It's exploding on social media. The hashtags Bolton a bombshell and blindsided among the trending terms on Twitter. Over on our Facebook page, Leah Keese says this about the revelations, which were leaked to the Times and are set to appear in a new tell-all book from Bolton. Leah says that Bolton has already said he would testify. However, it's a bit too, it's a case of too little, too late. The House wanted him to testify and asked him, subpoenaed aides to do so, and he fought it when this was in the House. Suddenly, this news drops and Bolton signals that he will testify in the Senate. Leah goes on to say that I believe what he says. He's known to be a straight shooter, but wonder about the timing. And meanwhile, Randy Smith says the real question is, does Bolton just get to collect a check for this book, or will they actually have him testify? Questions as yet to be answered, David.
What do you think, Texas? We would love to hear from you. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar back with more of your comments in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at WhiteMountainFoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
Hey, you got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Okay, so circle this date on your calendar. Tuesday, March 3rd, going to be a pretty super Tuesday. Texas, one of 14 states choosing candidates for president, for U.S. Senate, congressional races, and more. Early voting begins February 18th. But in three Texas districts, early voting's been underway for special runoffs already, with the final votes being cast tomorrow. Voters in Dallas County deciding who will fill the Texas House seat previously held by Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson. KERA's Bill Zeebel talked with the candidates.
Attorney and political campaign operative Lorraine Birabel drew 33% of the vote in November. Affordable home developer James Armstrong pulled 21%. Both call themselves the grassroots candidate.
We've been working really hard to make sure we're connecting at a grassroots neighbor-to-neighbor level.
Our mission and our campaign strategy has always been grassroots.
Armstrong focuses on improved childhood education and, like the developer he is, low-cost housing.
We have continued with our same messaging. We believe that the Texas promise of prosperity should be available to every Texan. It's that message to fight for things like early childhood education, equitable housing and economic development, expansion of public safety and transparency.
Birabel has stressed affordable health insurance. She recalls meeting a woman during her campaign, a young mother whose husband died of illness because he lacked health care. She lost the home, too.
And now she is a young mother with two children living in a one-bedroom apartment. I think so many people in our district who would be covered by the Medicaid expansion are in a similar situation. One job loss away, one medical diagnosis away from crisis.
Texas House District 100 includes parts of West Dallas, Oak Cliff, South Dallas, East Dallas, and a small part of Mesquite. In Dallas, I'm Bill Zeebel for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. One focus of the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration has been so-called anchor babies, or U.S.-born children of unauthorized immigrants. On Friday, the Trump administration took steps to restrict visas for pregnant women trying to visit the United States in an effort to curb what some see as a problem of, quote, birth tourism. Joining us now is Sarah Pierce. She is policy analyst for the Migration Policy Institute. Sarah, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Obviously, birth tourism isn't actually a legal term, but what is it that some are concerned about when they use that phrase, birth tourism?
So they're concerned about people who are coming to the United States specifically to take advantage of birthright citizenship. Birthright citizenship means that anyone born in the United States is a U.S. citizen. And there is a very small cottage industry in which companies advertise this to foreign nationals. They help foreign nationals enter the United States, maybe even house them and hook them up with medical care while they're waiting for the birth.
You say a very small cottage industry. Any way to know just how big or small it actually is?
Unfortunately, there isn't. The Department of State said that they think that this happens in the thousands each year. We know from the Center of Disease Control that 10,000 or less babies are born in the United States each year to foreign national mothers who reside outside of the United States. So we do think that this is a very, very small issue, but we don't have exact numbers on it.
Let's try to understand what it is exactly that the Trump administration is doing here. They have apparently informed their consular officers abroad to what? Be on the lookout for pregnant women seeking visas?
Yeah, pretty much. They didn't actually create anything new here. So it was already true that consular officers had the ability to deny women visas if they thought that those women were coming to the United States for the purpose of birth tourism. All this regulation did was really put that rule that was already there in the consular officers' minds into the regulation. So it's a little more explicit. So it's a little symbolic. It's placing a little more pressure on consular officers, mm-hmm. but it isn't actually doing a whole lot new.
Well, more and more women around the world are traveling for business these days, and they do so even when they are in the later stages of pregnancy. How would a consular officer or a visa official determine if a woman is traveling to the United States while pregnant with the intent of giving birth here?
So that's a really good question. And I think that that's the question coming out of this. We're putting consular officers in this really awkward position. The regulation says that if a consular officer thinks that the woman will give birth in the United States, mm-hmm. like they're going to give birth imminently, they should presume they're coming primarily for the purpose of birth tourism. So this puts the onus on the officer to figure out when the woman is going to give birth, which is very difficult. I've had two children. I did not know when they were going to arrive. So it's creating a really awkward position that's really pressuring these consular officers to delve into a really private area of these women's lives.
These officers aren't required to ask every woman if she's pregnant or anything like that, right? I mean, it's just that they are expected to be on the lookout for anything suspicious. I mean, this sounds really vague.
Yeah, we've heard mixed reporting from the administration about whether or not the officers will be restricted from asking women if they're pregnant or mm-hmm. if they're intending on becoming pregnant. One report we heard was that if the woman puts down that she's coming to the United States for medical purposes, then the officer will be permitted to ask. So it's, like I said, it's putting the officers in an impossible and really awkward position. This isn't a very easily enforceable rule.
Most people are aware of the 2017 travel ban. Is this effectively a kind of an expansion of the travel ban or no?
I don't think so. Like I said earlier, officers already had the ability to deny visas for this purpose, mm-hmm. and they already considered birth tourism an impermissible reason to be getting a tourist visa to the United States. So it's not really creating anything new. I think it's more just symbolic. It's the administration trying to say that they're cracking down on birth tourism, but in a really ineffective way and in a way that's very difficult to enforce.
Is there a more effective way? I mean, to the extent that this is an issue, what might be a better way to address it?
Absolutely. Going after those companies that very openly advertise that they engage in birth tourism would be the most effective way to go after this issue, rather than, you know, create this very awkward situation for every woman foreign national who's of childbearing age. If they actually go after those companies, if they charge them with federal crimes, especially, you know, perpetrating visa fraud, that would be a lot more effective way to do it. And this administration has. They issued federal charges against several individuals in the birth tourism industry in 2019, mm-hmm. But it doesn't look like they're pouring a lot of resources into it. So I think they should focus there if they really want to get after this.
Sarah Pierce is a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Ms. Pierce, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, only a day after the Austin City Council unanimously voted to stop arresting for low-level marijuana possession, Austin Police Chief Brian Manley says his department will be doing otherwise. At a news conference on Friday, Manley said marijuana, quote, is still illegal and we will still enforce marijuana law, close quote. City Council's resolution prohibits using city funds for THC testing in non-felony marijuana cases. The Austin Police Chief says pot is not a high priority, but the public should know that they'll still ticket or arrest folks for marijuana if police, quote, come across it. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, we got the Texas Roundup just ahead. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is expecting more cases of the coronavirus to surface in the United States. The agency has so far confirmed 5 infections in people who've recently visited Wuhan, China, where the outbreak began. In Texas, the Waco-McLennan County Public Health District is monitoring a Baylor University student who may have contracted the illness traveling abroad. The CDC's Nancy Messonnier said Sunday tests are still pending for about 75 people.
Right now, we have a handful of patients with this 2019 novel coronavirus in the United States. But at this time, in the U.S., 2019 novel coronavirus is not spreading in our community.
On Sunday, the Brazos County Health District confirmed a Texas A&M University student tested negative for the virus after visiting China. Texas added nearly 30,000 jobs last month, and the state's unemployment rate ticked up a tenth of a percent to 3.5% in December. KERA's Christopher Conley reports.
Jobs in trade, transportation, and utilities led the job growth in Texas last month, followed by the professional and business services sector and financial activities. Over the course of 2019, Texas employers added more than 342,000 jobs, putting the state's workforce at more than 14 million people. Last year, Texas had its lowest unemployment rate on record. Dallas-Fort Worth saw a 2.9% unemployment rate. Midland, Amarillo, and Austin saw the lowest unemployment rates in the state. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
NBA teams in Texas are honoring Lakers legend Kobe Bryant, who died in a helicopter crash Sunday. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban said in a statement last night, no player on the team will ever wear number 24 again. San Antonio Spurs coach Greg Popovich also discussed the 41-year-old's legacy following a game yesterday.
We all feel a deep sense of loss for what he meant to all of us in so many ways, and so many millions of people loved him for so many different reasons.
Bryant, one of his daughters, Gianna, and seven others were killed in the crash. That includes former University of Houston baseball player John Altobelli, his wife Carrie, and their daughter Alyssa. Governor Greg Abbott is set to speak at the Texas Capitol this morning for International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The event will commemorate the millions of victims of the genocide during World War II and recognize the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Project Innovate, inviting photographers of all levels to share their unique perspective of Texas. Top submissions will be showcased at the Dell Experience at South by Southwest. Details at projectinnovate.com/Texas.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. You know, most Texans probably have a fundamental idea of how oil and gas is produced. You have the raw material extracted from the ground and trucked off to plants where they're refined, but many people may be less familiar with the extraction waste that's also trucked off. Salty substance known as brine transported to treatment plants or injection wells where it's shot back into the earth. Well, as Justin Noble reports in a story in Rolling Stone this month, that brine is also radioactive, and he details how little transporters are told about the risks of brine and also how little regulation there is when it comes to the transportation of this radioactive substance. Justin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about this brine. Is this naturally occurring, or is this the water that's shot into injection wells, or what is brine?
Good question. Brine is a naturally occurring substance found in all oil and gas layers. So this does not necessarily have to do with what's being injected down in fracking. This material comes to the surface. It has a high salt content. It also, though, has toxic heavy metals, and it can have high levels of radium.
Well, let's talk about the differences. For instance, you were looking at an oil region up in around Ohio, Pennsylvania. That can be different from, like, say, what we see here in the Permian Basin, right?
It is. The radioactivity levels vary across plays. The Marcellus Shale happens to have an extraordinarily high radioactive level. Information on this goes back to USGS reports from the 1960s. But the Permian has high levels as well.
The issue, of course, is that it's not known just how high those levels are. And as you report, a lot of truckers have no idea that the brine that they're shipping is radioactive.
That's correct. They don't. And this is the really concerning find in my reporting. Drivers are often told they're hauling water, maybe they're hauling salt water. They are not told that they're hauling radioactive materials. And the reason that matters is because they're not appropriately protected from radioactive materials. They're not wearing the proper gear. The trucks aren't placarded or labeled appropriately, which means they can go on routes that put public and communities at risk. They can drive near schools or reservoirs, for example. That wouldn't be able to happen if these trucks were appropriately recognized as carrying radioactive materials.
I want to get back to why these materials are not classified as hazardous waste, but are people actually getting sick? I mean, is by transporting or coming into contact with this brine, what's happening?
Drivers I'm in touch with are complaining about certain symptoms, numbness, joint pain, severe headaches. We don't know if this is connected to radioactivity. It would be fantastic if certain health agencies started examining this issue. What we do know is there were a set of Louisiana legal cases only recently settled in which oil and gas worker cancers were linked to radioactivity exposure received on the job.
Let's get to this hazardous waste issue. You say, or you write, that if these trucks were in fact designated as carrying hazardous waste, they couldn't drive past schools, they couldn't drive past reservoirs, that sort of thing. So why is it that this brine isn't classified as a hazardous waste if it's known to be radioactive?
Yes, there was an act in the late 1970s called the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That was intended to handle the hazardous waste that the nation produced from cradle to grave. So a truck would have to be appropriately labeled. It would have to end up in an appropriate landfill. But oil and gas waste received an exemption from that act, which means even though, and the EPA actually looked at this in 1988, determined that there is concerning materials in oil and gas waste, even though there's uranium, even though there's toxic heavy metals, oil and gas waste has received a non-hazardous classification. All of this stems from that exemption.
So what does the industry have to say about all this?
Unfortunately, the industry hasn't given me much information. I've sent detailed questions asking for answers to each specific question. The American Petroleum Institute sent me back about a paragraph, and what's so striking there is the American Petroleum Institute has actually written about this. The American Petroleum Institute has a report from 1982 in which they expressed some significant concern over the radioactivity risk to workers due to some of these waste streams.
Justin Noble is the author of a forthcoming book, Petroleum 238. His most recent report appears in Rolling Stone. It's titled America's Radioactive Secret, and it was produced in part with assistance from the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a journalism nonprofit group. Justin, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us in the Texas Standard.
David, absolutely. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the 1970s, a singer-songwriter and conceptual artist named Terry Allen came out of Lubbock and stood conventional country music on its head. Albums like Juarez and Lubbock on Everything featured wry, dry, satirical lyrics, and critics would call them contemporary classics. Last week, 7 years after his last record, Terry Allen released his latest collection of songs, already being celebrated as the spiritual successor to his early greats, an album with a curious title, Just Like Moby Dick?
I had another title for it, kind of a working title when we were doing it. But there's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of pretty intense songs, just kind of about desperate circumstances of people's lives. And so obviously there's humor there too. But I wrote a song called Sailing On Through. And just on a fluke, when we were recording, I said at the very end of it, just like Moby Dick, you know, kind of getting through this.
So better break out the bottle and bring on the glass. Fill it up with the good stuff, cause everything must pass.
That resonated, I think, with the whole record, and I changed the sequences of the songs and whatever, and it built a through line, and it became one thing, which is what I always try to get a record to do.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because you, of course, are a visual artist as well, and yeah. You come from a kind of literary background or tradition, it seems to me. I mean, a lot of your work sort of echoes some of what the great novelists do, in a sense.
Well, they're stories. You know, you tell stories, and I think I grew up around hearing these outrageous, you know, lies and stories, and I guess it just sunk in.
Go to Afghanistan. Blood on that ancient land. Let death take hold your hand, oh, my high school girl.
I remember talking one time to Guy Clark about the creative process. Now, he had a different way of approaching it.
He always lied about the creative process.
Did he?
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
He pulled the wool over my eyes. But, you know, he was famous for having they called him the craftsman, right, and all that. And he had a real sort of meticulous sort of approach to it. Do you find, you don't strike me as that kind of artist, and yet you're right there with him among the masters of Texas music.
Well, I think everybody goes about that how they go about it. But for me, it's always been, it's kind of like every word counts. And I think when you make a song, it's always about the song. You try to find the kind of world that you're making, and then you try to make it be totally true to itself.
She had a number on some paper in her purse. That was the number we tried first. Yeah, but nobody answered every time we tried. We're the only ones in the world, and even though she died.
I've always thought of songs as like these movies that happen in your head when you hear a song. They're like an abbreviation, in a sense, that just opens up a door to a world for you.
Yeah, they shut down the mill, but now there's no one around. She was the last stripper, the last club in town. Can't say that I knew her, can't say we were friends, but I still try that number every now and then.
Tell us a little bit about the inspiration there for City of Vampires. What is the City of Vampires?
The City of Vampires is a world that lived in my grandson's head, my 10-year-old grandson. He got very obsessed with vampires.
When the circus comes to town, in the City of the Vampires.
So I started working on the song, just thinking about vampires. And he also said, well, there needs to be a circus, and there needs to be wolves, and there needs to be clowns, there needs to be elephants.
Well, the big top at night is a glow. Vain painted clowns are performing.
And then also on the record, after we recorded, brought him in to do the hissing.
Oh, that's great. So that's your grandson.
So he's got co-writing credit on the record.
Now, one other question I wanted to ask you, since we had touched on Guy Clark. Someone told me that you were in possession of Guy's ashes. Is that true?
Years he told me he wanted me to put his ashes in a piece of mine, in some kind of sculpture piece. And we jived about it. I would always just say, Guy, you know, I'm going to take your ashes and I'm going to do a bronze goat and I'm going to shove your ashes right up its and he'd go, perfect. So, you know, when he died, he had gotten really interested in the Windmill Museum in Lubbock. He had seen two crow's nests in there that were in windmill derricks. And the crow's nests were from the Dust Bowl, and they were made out of only barbed wire and baling wire.
Wow.
And every time I talked to him, last 3 or 4 years of his life, he would bring up that nest, and he was trying to write a song about those crows and about that sparseness of making something so beautiful out of nothing. Actually, I think he finally did finish the song. It's on Rodney Crowell. Rodney helped him finish it, and it's on Rodney's new record called Texas, called Call Call Blues.
Dodging that buckshot, singing that song. Call, call, blues, call, call, blues. 10 against 20 if you're counting by twos. Bob, Bob, palace full of magpie chicks. Oh, heckling
seemed to me he was talking about a lot more than these crows or what. He was talking about really what was happening to him. And so I just felt the need to make a big bronze crow. When the bronze was molten state, I poured some of the ashes in it. So it's the whole body is made out of ashes. Wow. And then I opened it up and put the rest inside and sealed it. But I wish I had shoved it up the crow's instead of its chest.
No more one last time. No more second chances. We've worn out all the lines.
Terry Allen's new album is called Just Like Moby Dick, and that sculpture he made using Guy Clark's ashes, well, he just donated it to the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University in San Marcos.
All the scepters.
Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. President Trump's legal team set to continue their opening arguments in the Senate impeachment trial today. How long this process will go on and whether any witnesses will be called still in question. This, as the New York Times reports an account from the forthcoming book by former National Security Advisor John Bolton, in which he claims he was told by the president that aid to Ukraine was being held until the country agreed to investigations into former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Up to now, the Senate seemed divided along party lines on whether to convict or acquit. Not clear what impact all this will have in D.C., but how's this drama going down in Texas, especially among women? Well, the Houston Chronicle and other Hearst newspapers in Texas have been asking that very question. Andrea Zielinski is political reporter for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News. Andrea, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Happy to be here.
Have to ask, why did you want to focus on women specifically here in Texas?
Well, women are such a political get right now. Both parties really want to make sure that they're getting the attention of women, mostly because in the last election, we saw some flippage, particularly women in the suburbs. So both parties are really trying to capture their attention. So we naturally, we want to know what everybody is thinking right now, how they view the political landscape. But we want to zero in a bit more on this group of people that in maybe past elections have been a little overlooked and now mm-hmm. are really a target.
Yeah, a politically volatile segment of the Texas citizenry. So how is impeachment playing out across the Lone Star State when it comes to women?
What I found was that a lot of people really are pushed to the edges. It's hard to find people who are in the middle. When I do find somebody in the middle, it's kind of like a three-legged cat. They have it's almost like a kind of like a buffet. They have some opinions on one side, some of the other. But a lot of people in the middle are also more reticent to be on the record with me. So that's been a little bit of a challenge. So there are people there, but most of the people I'm finding are really hard in one of the corners. And they're not interested in being swayed so much. Some are a little bit more open than others. And I'm also finding the vast majority are listening to news sources that agree with their own political opinion. Mm-hmm. I am finding some people on both sides who listen to both, somebody who, hears a story on Fox News and then wants to see how MSNBC covers it or vice versa.
Yeah.
There are definitely those people out there, but that's not the majority.
People's minds already made up. Very interesting. Well, so what does this tell us or foretell us about 2020? This is an important election year. And after all, you wanted to get some insight as to, how this was playing out among a politically important demographic.
I think what this tells us is that both parties are going to spend a lot of time, rallying their base, making sure that all these people that are in their corners are really motivated to come out to vote. But it also means they're you know, there are those swing voters in the middle, those independents. There was a recent poll that had that showed that America was pretty split down the middle on impeachment, and there was maybe like a 6% wiggle room of people in the middle who were undecided. So I think we're going to see, especially once we get through the primaries, more focus on trying to swing those people one way or the other, because that could really make or break it this election season.
Just a couple of seconds left, but do you have a sense that whatever the outcome of this impeachment trial, that it will move the needle in Texas?
Not in Texas. Not very far. I think the needle might move a little bit, but I think for the most part, particularly in Texas, you have a lot of folks who are progressive in big cities, a lot of people who are hardcore, both hardcore conservative in more suburban and more rural areas, more in the rural areas. And the suburbs are really where I think a lot of that battle is going to play out. Hmm.
Andrea Zielinski covers politics for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Andrea, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Hey there, Wells Dunbar.
Hey, David Brown. What's happening?
Wells is our social media editor. What are you seeing out there?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, this back and forth between Austin's city council and the chief of police harshing the mellow of proponents of pot decriminalization. Yes.
That's what you did there.
As we've been talking about on the show, Austin's recent refusal to purchase this testing equipment to differentiate between marijuana and hemp effectively created this scenario where council members said minor pot possession wouldn't be prosecuted in the capital city. But its police chief, Brian Manley, has said nothing has changed and police will continue to enforce the law, citations, arrests as necessary, to which the council member that made this proposal, Greg Kassar, has dismissed those citations as useless, similarly saying that any court appearance will summarily be dismissed without this testing to differentiate. So interesting sort of dispute that the city is finding itself in that has captured the attention of our friends and listeners. On Facebook, Randy Smith says the police chief probably doesn't want to lose all that asset forfeiture cash those cannabis arrests bring in. Mm-hmm. However, Jordan Peterson says police are required to enforce the law. The prohibition of marijuana is not a city law. Use your head. To which Michael Buclair, he responds that police can enforce a law they are not able to provide evidence of a crime with. How is that enforcing the law? Really getting to the sort of issue at heart here, that without that information to differentiate, to make sure that something is indeed marijuana, how can you arrest and prosecute for
it? Well, as you may, listeners may be aware, the Texas Department of Public Safety has been working on coming up with a fix for this, apparently, and it's my understanding that this fix, once it's rolled out, will help departments that don't have that kind of budget for testing
Very
to actually do the testing.
Interesting.
So, they've been thinking about this. Got the angles covered, I guess.
You're not going to let... I think about the back and forth between the city and the state over issues like this, these local control issues. So, yeah, I can see this one raising a few red flags at the state capitol.
You know that. Hey, did you watch the Grammys?
Didn't get a chance, but I know, as we were talking about earlier, Texas artists acquitted themselves quite well.
They did. I don't know if you've ever visited that Texas Music Office website. It's very, very nice website, but they've got the whole rundown here. 13 Texas acts winning 17 Grammys at the 2020 Recording Academy Awards.
Does that include Lizzo? Because,
that does include
Lizzo. That's the
Texas
thing. It's, she doesn't. She's not in Texas, but we still claim her as our own.
Well,
because
she's
hails
Houston.
From Texas.
Houston,
yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Best pop solo performance for Truth Hurts. Best traditional R&B performance for Jerome, and best urban contemporary album for 'Cause I Love You. So she did rather well. Patty Griffin from Austin. Best folk album for the eponymous album. Gary Clark Jr. also from the Texas Capital City, best contemporary blues album.
Yeah, I think he had a real nice performance with The Roots, is what I was
last night's show. Yeah, he's an incredible guitar player. Beyonce, best music film for Homecoming. Blanton Allspaugh, you classical music lovers, producer of the year for classical, including several works released during the year. There's a whole lot more over at texasmusicoffice.org. Just look them up. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a mighty marvelous Monday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.